Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Robert Gianfrancaro, Executive Medical Director of Population Health and Virtual Care at the University of North Carolina, about virtual care from telehealth to telemedicine. This is really kind of the future of healthcare in many respects, and I think this bedrock will always be what's happening in front of us with doctor and patient. But a lot of times, the shifting of this doctor-patient relationship can go from the bedside to perhaps the home. And those are sometimes good things if you can get in and be seen without actually coming in. But first, we got some really interesting research that matters. I would say the first one is taking the science we know and applying it in ways that are really important. And that has to do with smoking during pregnancy. Virtually everyone knows today that smoking in pregnancy is a no-no, as smoking after pregnancy is also a no-no. And I think if you would ask most pregnant women, they would say, even if they were smoking before, and they'd say, yes, we know we're going to try to quit or quit during pregnancy. However, it's not that simple because we're talking about an addiction. And then increasingly, in terms of pregnancy, a lot of the burden of that addiction falls on low-income women who smoke at higher rates, and the resources may not be as easily available. So this is research in Colorado that was published in the journal Public Health Nursing. And it looked at an intervention called Baby in Me Tobacco Free. And they were trying to understand, what if they took what they know about what might work with helping pregnant mothers quit smoking with counseling and support, and then also applied that with some incentives to really help the women stay free. The incentives in this case were diaper vouchers contingent on cessation status. And then they did one last thing, which is they gave feedback to the women, the carbon monoxide levels. You can measure carbon monoxide, which is a direct byproduct of smoking, and you can see whether or not if they've actually quit and they're quitting and the levels go down. So this kind of feedback to the women. What they found is that those who participate in this Baby and Me and Tobacco-Free program had about a 25% reduction in the risk of preterm birth, which is a known consequence of smoking. And they had a 25 to 50% reduction in risk of actually having to go into the neonatal intensive care unit. And this actually translated into really significant cost saving. Calculated cost savings that associated with this program could have been $4 million. And then looking at it as it compares to other populations in the state, certainly over $1.5 million. So these are win-wins: lower disease, higher cost savings. And I think this is really the future of what we really need to be thinking about in terms of some population health. Our next research that matters is the pictures we see of others in the media. And when photos get retouched, get redone so that the people in these pictures, maybe in this particular case, appear much thinner. And this was actually in the journal Body Image. And it's what happens when those who are using these images, a lot of times of younger, attractive women who appear even thinner than they perhaps even are. And there's a disclaimer put on there that this has been a retouched image. This is not the original person. And the question is, how do women see this particular impact? And is this a thing that could really be of concern? And what they did is they did a review of 15 different studies that have been done on this particular topic. It's one of the systematic reviews. And they found that these disclaimers were actually ineffective at reducing women's body dissatisfaction following exposure to these thin ideal images. So having these disclaimers really didn't do anything, telling women that, oh, these are kind of fake, they've been altered. So I think this is one of those things here that we really need to actually get some good research to show how do we either stop this practice, though I think under First Amendment people, you know, and people have the right, you know, for advertising, but I think how we then try to mitigate impacts. Our third research that matters has to do with something that's near and dear to probably all of us, which is our cell phones and talking or searching while we're walking, driving, doing things. So if any of you are out there listening to the radio show, you got your cell phone on and you're actually walking or driving, please put it down right now. Let's just listen to the show and listen to this research, which shows that these cell phone distractions actually have been linked to an increasing amount of head and neck injuries. This seems to have gotten worse since certain advances like the iPhone 2007, Pokemon Go in 2016. This was a study from Rutgers published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Head and Neck Surgery Journal, and it reviewed 2,500 emergency department patients and the head and neck injuries they had from cell phone use between 1998 and 2017, and continued steady increase of these injuries, cuts, bruises, internal injuries on the eye and nose, 41% at home, 50% from distracted driving, and 1/3 from distracted walking. We all know we've seen people walking across the street, not seeing cars, not seeing others, and even among children younger than age 13, they can have mechanical injuries, such as a parent dropping something or them dropping it on a younger sibling or banging themselves in the face. This solution is pretty simple. How we get there, I think, is going to require more research, more talking, and less walking with our cell phones. Our last research that matters has to do with permanent hair dyes and straighteners. And among many women, the use of hair dyes and straighteners is very frequent. The question is this a problem? And this journal, the International Journal of Cancer, really was looking at that there was an increased breast cancer risk with more frequent use of chemical hair products. I suspect most of our listeners would not know exactly what's in these products. What are the chemicals in there? And I think this research, because it shows that there is this increased risk if they use permanent hair dyes for 5 or 8 weeks or more, was a much higher risk. It was actually 8% increased risk for white women, a 60% increase in breast cancer for African-American women, and then equal increase for straightening. And I think it raises really important questions about women who would like to lower risk, women who should be aware of potential risk. And while this research, I think, is provocative, it doesn't show causality, I think it's worth looking at, as we do with all chemicals and all the products we're using in trying to improve our health. Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Robert Gianfocaro, Executive Medical Director of Population Health and Virtual Care at the University of North Carolina, about virtual care, from telehealth to telemedicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Robert Gianfocaro, Executive Medical Director of Population Health and Virtual Care at the University of North Carolina, about virtual care from telehealth to telemedicine. Welcome, Dr. Gianfocaro.
Well, thank you, Adam. Happy to be here.
You know, Bob, we've known each other for a good while and been able to kind of watch your leadership in the University of North Carolina School of Medicine system for, I would just say, innovative ways of delivering care. And before we dive into this whole field of virtual care, tell us a little bit about your path. How did you get interested in primary care and this innovative aspect of care?
Sure. It really goes back quite a few years, even in the time prior to coming to the University of North Carolina, where I was in private practice. And I always looked for opportunities to improve the interactions and the access of patients to my practice, utilizing any of the technologies that were available at the time. Then clearly, when we had the breakthrough in smartphones and video interactions between people, the opportunity to apply that technology to healthcare was obviously in the forefront of our minds.
So as we think about this intersection of clinical care versus virtual care, the in-office visit versus population health, help us understand. I know we got some terms here to work through, but understand these shifts that you are on the cutting edge of helping both providers and patients understand.
First, start with population health. So when we think about the patients that we care for as providers and physicians, many of the common disease states that we care for can be looked at on an individual basis or on a larger, more global scale. So what I would like to know from my patients that I care for is, how many diabetics do I care for? And of those diabetics, how many of them are on the right medications? How many are achieving their goals in terms of medication, weight loss, exercise, dietary compliance? And then as a result of that, how many of them are attaining their goal of a normal blood sugar or hemoglobin A1C? Once I have that type of data, which with the advent of electronic medical records has certainly helped us more easily obtain, now I can focus my care on those individual patients and meet their specific needs and assist them in reaching their own individual goals on a patient level. By taking that 30,000-foot view, we can understand the needs of our, not only our practice populations, but the populations within our community, the populations within our state, and then make sure that those patients are receiving the resources that they need to maintain their health.
Let's just break that down for 1 second. I'm going to describe the patient that's your patient and my patient and all primary care docs' patient. You know, we have a 60-year-old man who happens to be overweight, who happens to have diabetes, high blood pressure, quit smoking recently, asthma, arthritis. With this population health, there are anywhere from 10 to 20 things we need to be intervening on, because they don't exercise too. And we know that from a provider's standpoint, we can't do all that with that one patient and the individual level ourselves, because we would be so overwhelmed with the type of work we'd have to do with all of these patients like that. So where is this population health at this intersection of, I wanted to say, public health versus this, the doc can't do all this?
Absolutely. And that's probably one of the biggest frustrations that we have as physicians, is the limited time that we have with our patients. And so that interaction with the patient should not be limited to the time available in a face-to-face visit. And so what I need to do is develop a care team. And these are other members of my clinic or my practice that are also involved in that care of the patient, people such as social workers, dietitians, pharmacists, care managers, all of us sharing the responsibility of providing that patient with the information, feedback, and monitoring that is required to improve their clinical condition. You're absolutely right. Many of our patients are very, very complex, and we need the support of a care team to provide that service.
The driver of that, we'd like to say it's quality. We're hoping we're giving better care to people. We'd like to say that it improves experience of care, but we also are trying to see whether or not it can reduce the cost of care. Isn't that a major reason why we're doing this? And how does that play out in the work that you do?
Correct. So the idea there is that it's a combination of the quality and the cost of care. We want to ensure that our patients are receiving the care that they need in a timely fashion, that they are being interacted with on multiple levels. So they may be seeing me every 3 to 6 months, but they're in contact with a member of the care team far more frequently than that, perhaps even monthly or weekly for certain patients that require that level of care. And the ultimate goal is by providing that care, by engaging that patient in their own care, we can then intervene earlier during the course of a disease or the course of an illness and prevent the unnecessary care that often develops when a patient finally decides that, oh, I should be seen and I can't get into the doctor's office, but I'm going to the emergency room and I may end up being hospitalized because their symptoms have gotten to such a point that we've missed that opportunity to intervene.
So I kept my asthmatic patient out of the emergency room, which then kept them out of the hospital because I was able to prevent the asthma flare that certainly would have come on if we hadn't thought like that.
Correct.
So help us then define this quantum leap forward to virtual care, because I think we can see these teams, we can see this interaction there, but then there's this new term. What's the whole rationale, goal, and how does this fit within this interplay with this population health team-based care?
So the importance of the team-based care in population health is based upon the ability to interact and for the patient to have access to their care team when they need it, not when it's convenient for the doctor to say, I have an appointment time for you in 6 months. And so by looking at other technologies that we can utilize to grant that or provide that improved access to the patients, they now can receive the care in a timely manner at the point where they feel they need to be seen. And they no longer have to do that with only a face-to-face visit. What they can do is they can engage in virtual care. And virtual care is a catch-all term. And depending on where you are in the different areas of the country, it may have variations in its definition. The definition for virtual care encompasses anything that is done remotely. When we talk about telemedicine, think of that more in the traditional sense. It's an interaction with your physician that occurs through the electronic means of communication, through a video audio connection, much like Skype or FaceTime, that is HIPAA compliant and allows you to communicate with your provider that way. When we talk about telehealth is also a larger term that takes into account everything that a patient can do to interact with the healthcare system, and that may be coaching or counseling or education. It may be related to the interaction with other members of the care team, and including monitoring with your mobile devices and your Fitbits and the types of wearables that are now available to our patients, all which can help us care for and monitor the patient's progress.
Well, we've got a whole universe to explore, which we're going to do in just a second, but we do need to take a short break. When we return, we're going to continue talking with Dr. Robert Gianforcaro, Executive Medical Director of Population Health and Virtual Care at the University of North Carolina, about virtual care from telehealth to telemedicine. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we've been talking with Dr. Robert Gianforcaro, Executive Medical Director of Population Health and Virtual Care at the University of North Carolina, about virtual care, telehealth, and telemedicine. And right before the break, Bob, you were really starting, I think, to outline for us the scope and I think an expansive scope about the possibilities. Give us, if you would, maybe three examples of things that may be occurring through this expanded technology.
So the three things that I think are probably on everyone's to-do list are the video visits with their physician or member of their care team. This is where a patient would be able to interact through that audio-video connection and have a virtual appointment, particularly in instances where these are follow-up appointments that don't necessarily require a physical examination. Another would be an e-visit. An e-visit is a structured questionnaire that branches with logic and that the patient would then have access to through their patient portal. And they can ask their provider many questions related to a specific diagnosis. So, for example, if your asthmatic is not feeling well today and they can't access your clinic because of transportation issues or babysitting issues or work issues, they can submit an e-visit to you that helps develop their symptoms and their complaints and help you understand how they are feeling today, and you can quickly respond to them to provide them the care that they need at that time. Other things that are clearly being explored are things such as e-consults, that if I'm seeing a patient who would benefit from the opinion of a cardiologist, but they don't really need to see the cardiologist, it might be with a medication adjustment or a medication addition, I can send an e-consult to a cardiologist that would help me manage that particular patient and help avoid the unnecessary visit to a cardiology practice for a consult. Again, providing immediate care at a lower cost with better outcomes for the patient. Then our brain can start to expand and we can think about all of the other beneficial aspects of having this data on hand, where we can start doing predictive analytics and using artificial intelligence to analyze the data that we have on our patients to be able to perhaps predict when that patient is going to have an asthma flare based on many of the clinical factors and some of the wearable devices and the data that's coming in from that.
So all of these examples, Bob, are really exciting, and I do think from a patient perspective offers really great opportunities for this improved care and the reduced cost of care you talked about earlier and better quality. One of the questions I have is, who's paying for it and how does that payment model work? Because it seems like it may be, could be wrong, more difficult to pay for this in certain models than particularly also changing the culture of everything's been built on a culture of, you know, fee for service. When you come in, you get the service.
And, you know, Adam, that's probably one of the biggest barriers and challenges we have today, particularly in North Carolina. This is a perfect example of how technology has progressed at a speed that is far beyond what is currently being done by the payers, the insurers, and both the commercial insurers and governmental payers such as Medicare and Medicaid in the state of North Carolina. Many states have legislation that requires the insurers to pay for virtual care, video visits, e-consults, but unfortunately, North Carolina is not one of those states, and therefore we do not have appropriate coverage for many of these services for our patients.
So as we then think about this demand for a service, where's the push coming from? It seems like there, you know, a lot of times medicine moves and does the right thing when it's pushed and encouraged to do the right thing. Are the national, those who are trying to change, reduce costs, are Blue Cross Blue Shields of the world, the Medicares of the world, the Medicaids, are they really pushing or encouraging this because they see that this is part of the future?
The short answer is yes, but it's a little more complicated than that. So I would say that the push is coming from several areas. Number one, our patients are smart. They are capable. Every 90% of people have a smartphone. And so they want to be connected, they want to be engaged in their care, and they want to have that access and communication with their care providers. So patients are driving this. Physicians and providers are driving this. We know, and we've heard many times that there are shortages of physicians in many areas of the country. And even within our own state, there are areas of lack of sufficient providers. So this technology allows a provider to expand their services to a community that may be underserved. Then the insurers are certainly getting on the bandwagon and understanding that this can help reduce the cost of care, thereby reducing the cost of the health insurance premiums. Medicare is making significant advances in their coverage for virtual care services, and year upon year, they've expanded what they will cover. I would certainly anticipate that in the next 2 to 3 years, we're going to see this continue to rapidly grow across payers and the demand by patients to be able to engage this way.
You know, it's really fascinating to think about what is it that we want, because we're also patients. We're doctors, but we're patients. You and I both travel a lot, and we may have needs while we're traveling to actually be in touch with our provider, with their office. I remember last year when I was traveling and I was at the beach on vacation, and I developed some really, you know, lifting up something I shouldn't have lifted up. and all of a sudden you hear something, you know, it happened in your back. You go, that's not good. And really needing to be in touch with my office. And I think being able to access someone quickly was such a blessing, but that's not given for lots of people.
That's correct. There are issues related to you being out at the beach. Did you have, number one, does your provider, your physician, does he participate in virtual care or telemedicine? Is there adequate bandwidth out at the beach where you were? And we know in North Carolina, many of our communities do not have adequate bandwidth so that they don't even have internet at home, or the cellular coverage is very erratic in some of the more remote regions of the state. And so they may not be able to access it because of some of the technological barriers that currently exist in our communities.
And what I really appreciated was also, it was the low tech. The office was receptive to an interruption in the day to get a provider on the line who could handle something more quickly and could, in this particular case, it was just to call on a refill of a medicine that would help the back, ibuprofen-like things, but could call it in to a different state. In this case, I was in South Carolina, and yet that sort of thing could save you an ER visit. It could save you an urgent care visit, and it took actually a very little time. Now, in this particular case, the provider doesn't get paid for that other than a great big thank you and maybe some flowers from their patient.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of times it's the thank yous that mean a lot as well. There are fairly significant restrictions about providing this within or outside of a particular state. So state licensure requirements are also something that need to be considered. In general, most of the states in the country require you to have a license in the state where the patient is at the time of that telemedicine visit. And so that can oftentimes be a barrier as well. But you're absolutely right, Adam. You know, having access is important, and that's important for the patient, but it's also important for me. Why should I be or you be limited to only being able to communicate and care for your patients one way, and that's in a face-to-face visit, which is highly inefficient for many of the situations that we are faced with on a daily basis. This, I want to be clear, though, you know, these virtual services, telemedicine services, are not for every clinical condition. Nothing takes the place of a face-to-face evaluation where an examination can be completed, and there are many complex problems that are not appropriate for a telemedicine visit.
I think you've made a really good distinction between there's a fee for a service, this face-to-face, there's a fee for a value. This, it was highly valuable for me to be able to avoid an emergency room. And I guess my last question for you, Bob, is let's fast forward 10 years. Where are we going to be at? Are we incrementally changed? Are we fundamentally changed? And what's your kind of your vision, your hope for where we might be?
That's an interesting question. So the analogy that I like to use is on-demand manufacturing, or just-in-time manufacturing, it's called, where manufacturers no longer produce warehouses full of materials. You put in an order, the order is completed and shipped. Just imagine healthcare. If we can connect these silos that currently exist, the people that are doing direct patient care, people that are doing hospital care, people that are doing home care, if all of that data were able to be integrated so that at any one time, any interaction with a patient, that information would flow seamlessly to the next step of care that is necessary. So you have a patient at home that is having some difficulties that's been identified by a monitoring device or by the home health nurse, and that information is immediately transferred to a physician who's available to respond to the patient, adjust treatment and medication, and avoid unnecessary hospitalizations, ED visits, but also intervene earlier on so that that patient never have to even consider going to one of the facilities for care. So this on-demand, just-in-time healthcare, I think, is the dream that we should all have.
Well, I think we have to say that the interview with you today was just in time. And I think we are so appreciative, Dr. Robert Jim Furcaro, for your time today and this vision and bringing us up to speed a little bit. I think all of us, really, this is a roller coaster, and we're on it, and sometimes it's hard to see what's around you. And so, you know, describing what's around us and helping us understand where the roller coaster is going. Thank you so much for doing that with us today.
Thank you for having me, and it's been a pleasure.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if any listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I recently had an echocardiogram or an ultrasound of my heart. The doctor was concerned because I had borderline blood pressures despite taking blood pressure meds. He said the echocardiogram was good but did show a slight thickening of one of my heart chambers and suggested adding a second medicine or losing 25 pounds over the next year. He said both would probably help. What do you think?
No, I think your doctor's probably right.
There you go. Simple answer.
They both would probably help. You know, it's interesting, Laura, in light of our guest, Dr. Jim Furcaro, and the recent interview we just did, is this idea of telehealth, telemedicine. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a kind of a really good example of a doctor getting a test result and then using that test result to change care and trying to, you know, avoid worsening heart problems that would maybe lead to heart failure.
Right.
And the question really is, how does that data then of changes that get done, let's say a new blood pressure gets done, how does the patient monitor their blood pressure, get that data back to the provider? You know, coming back into the office once a week for 4 weeks and getting 4 blood pressure values, that's hard for everyone. But in this particular case, maybe just getting a change of medicine and then getting 4 blood pressures with a home monitoring device and having that tied up to be able to feed back in to the provider, and the provider once a week can get 30 readings.
Right.
For a day, for a week, that is transformative.
Yeah. Are home blood pressure monitoring devices generally pretty reliable, you think?
Yeah. And we've done some work on the show about those in the past, and they're pretty good. And particularly over time, you get to see a change that's pretty reliable.
Even if it's not exactly
time. Even if one of them, you know, yeah. And that's what really counts here. The weight loss, that does take time. But again, that could be fed back in with changes that are happening and fed back into a nurse or a coach. Exciting things, preventing this heart thickening from getting worse and maybe reversing it.
Oh, that's always good.
Yeah, that's a goal. What's our very next house call?
I have a pet peeve. When I come to the doctor and get blood work, I expect to get the results pretty quickly, but it seems that unless I call to get those results, I rarely see them within a week, and sometimes I have to call multiple times. This is the kind of service I would expect from airlines, not my doctor. Yikes.
Yeah, that's one I am not defending because I think all doctors really struggle And before these electronic health records came about, it was a struggle because you had to look at the thing. You either had to call the patient, mm-hmm. you had to mail something in the mail. And today we have what's called kind of my chart with these electronic health records where you can release it really quickly. Matter of fact, most patients within a week are going to be able to look at their results. That's kind of the default, that you can actually see your results.
Right.
The problem is you don't know how to interpret those results. And so one of the issues is that, you know, if you have a practice with 40 providers, you might have 40 different ways that the provider responds to patients. Some providers maybe send it that day. Some providers don't say anything and they just release it. Some providers call. Some providers mail. So you would like a system.
Right.
And I think where we can really improve upon and learn from others are better systems. I'm not going to defend the airline industry.
Sure.
You know, for this particular one. But there are other industries. I think we see systems within the banking that's made it easier to find out your balance.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
At any point in time. And you see a lot of times when you go online, people, you know, there's a little person who shows up with a little thing because, you know, can I help you?
Yeah. Can I help you today?
Right. And I'm thinking, is that a person? Is it really that person?
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's the sort of thing that we should be doing, some additional new technology that is a better system.
Libraries at university systems, I've noticed, often do that. They'll have a librarian sort of on call managing the chat function. And if somebody has a question, they'll, you know, respond when they can or as soon as possible.
So I think we're going to take this as an opportunity to challenge ourselves to do better.
Nice.
What's our very next house call?
How often do I need to get my blood level checked when I'm on a new blood thinner? I've heard if it's too low or too high, I could be in danger. I don't want to have a stroke, but it does take a lot of time to come in the doctor's office every week to get it checked.
Well, we have to make assumptions about that question. And first off, thank you for the question. And it's an important one because in the old ways of doing things, we had what was called Coumadin or warfarin. It's the blood thinner. That's probably what this patient's talking about.
Okay.
It's the one that you want that level sometimes between 2 or 3 or 2.5 and 3.5, depending on what condition you're treating. And if it's too low, you could have a blood clot. If it's too high, you could bleed and probably get really sick or in the hospital. And the problem is it takes a while for it to get stable. It could take a month or 6 weeks for it to be stable after you start it. Usually when it's stable, you can have it done once a month.
Okay.
And the question that I really like to ask is, what stops the technology from allowing patients to monitor these things at home? And right now, it's a very easy test to do, but the machines are expensive.
And what is the test?
It's a home blood thinning level. We call it the home Coumadin level.
And, like a prick of the finger or something?
Yeah. And so I think getting that cost down, getting it more in use, letting patients have more control, and then having that data fed back, just like we talked about with Dr. Gina Ficorro. That's the challenge that we have to do. Some of the newer medicines, you don't have to monitor them because there are really no blood tests for the level in your bloodstream, but they're really expensive for a lot of patients.
Mm-hmm.
So I like the newer medicines for lots of reasons, but again, until the cost comes down, a lot of patients can't afford them.
Right.
What's our very last house call?
I have heard that there's increasing interest in plant-based diets compared to animal-based diets. I had thought this was because of heart and cancer issues, but now I'm more recently hearing that it's an environmental issue, like a greenhouse gas issue. How does that make sense?
Well, it's interesting because I think most of us who do work in trying to change people's lifestyles and diets, you know, we talk about the Mediterranean diet, we talk about all these other diets that tend to emphasize plant-based sources.
Right.
And that a lot of times for weight loss or for heart disease, sometimes, you know, maybe cancer. But I think like this listener says, we don't necessarily think about them as they may relate to the environment.
Right.
And so we do know that, you know, ounce for what you need for your calories, if you rely on animal-based diets, those are much more environmentally intensive things because feeding livestock and the livestock waste and the water for those things. So it takes more water, it takes more energy, it has more environmental consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And I have seen this data that says that if society moved more towards plant-based diets, the impact might be as great as what we're trying to do with automobile emissions.
It's amazing. Yeah.
And I think this gives us something to really work for and think about: healthier, less costly, and less environmental damage. Those are win-win-wins.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. And we want to thank all of our listeners today for joining us. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to you and your health. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Robert Gianforcaro. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of your health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.